All right, so as always, I start out by asking whether you had comments and questions on last week's class, and then on whether you had comments and questions on the reading of this. We now have a very detailed account of a legal system from a very famous and rather weird society, and I was wondering if you had any particular reactions to that one. What are our sources of information? The book goes into that. We've got texts of some laws that have survived, but a lot of what we're relying on are the orations, which were sometimes good enough literature to have survived as literature, and which are presumably as one-sided as briefs would be nowadays, or as talks given in court would be nowadays. So we don't know how accurate their account of the law is, and we don't generally have orations from both sides for any particular case. In addition, there's a good deal of Athenian literature that has survived. In particular, there's a good deal of plays, comedies and such, and they have incidents in them from which you can derive plausible guesses. The book and my discussion is basically the period 435 to 322 BC, roughly, which is roughly from Pericles to Demosthenes, partly because that's when we have data. And in the book, when they give dates with a slash in it, that's an Athenian year, which is measured summer to summer and therefore covers parts of two of our years. If you'd like a vivid fictional portrayal of that society, let me recommend Mary Renault, who is a historical novelist, I think no longer alive, but one of the sort of, I would say, great historical novelists of the 20th century, almost all of whose work is set in ancient Greece, and a large part of it in ancient Athens. She has one series which are much earlier and much more conjectural, in which the central figure is Theseus, who is basically a sort of legendary hero by this time. But a good deal of it is this society. She also has a three-volume Alexander series, which intersects with this. Of course, Alexander's up in Macedon, not at Athens, but he has interaction with the with the Athenians, and his father, I think that Philip actually spent some time in Athens, if I remember correctly. The impression you get in that one is Demosthenes is really the villain which is sort of neat, of Mary Renault's story. He's sort of a demagogue. There's one scene where there's a battle, and the Athenian, and he's running away, and one of the other soldiers says, "Why, Demosthenes told us, you know, this great heroic speech, why he shouldn't run away," and he just keeps running and doesn't tell them who he is, and various other interesting things, but he comes across very much as a demagogue, and that's sort of neat because he's famous and usually seen as a good guy. And the impression you get in Renault is that Philip of Macedon, Alexander's father, really was sort of pro-Athenian and saw himself as the protector of Greece. He sort of wanted to be the leader. Macedon is a sort of half-barbarian, half-Greek society, but much better at fighting people than the Greeks are by this time. And unfortunately, he couldn't persuade the Athenians, and so he ends up fighting against various Greek city-states and defeating them before going off and starting the conquest of Persia, which is what Alexander does. But they're interesting books, I think, and I would recommend them for lots of different reasons, including that one. And the impression I get is that Renault really identifies with sort of the Greek attitude and Greek politics and such more than with modern politics. She's a sort of interesting character in lots of ways. So what else is interesting in that system? A whole lot of different stuff. We think of it as a democracy, and that's a little misleading in a couple of ways. For example, a sizable fraction of the population were slaves. We don't know how many. In addition to which, another sizable fraction were medics, and medics were resident aliens, sometimes second or third generation resident aliens who weren't citizens. So the rights of the Athenians are really the rights of the adult male Athenian citizens, who are obviously a minority and perhaps a not terribly large minority of that of that society. And the requirement to be a citizen initially was that your father was a citizen, and later that both parents were citizens, that you got a law passed at one point which basically says that a citizen can't marry a wife who is not a citizen. In fact, I think either direction you can't. One of the sort of interesting things at the beginning is that the original system seems to have been four hereditary tribes. And then Solon sort of did his own mix and match kind of thing out of it. He reformed the whole system in which he creates small groups. Think of them as parishes called deems, which are geographical. And he then creates, for legal purposes, 10 tribes, which are, each of them is a collection of deems, but not a geographical collection. So he's switching it from a presumably geographical loyalty to a, they're members of my tribe, even though this guy lives over there and this guy lives over there, and then parts of the political system end up being based on that.
Now, is this just within Athens, or is this Greece as a whole?
Athens. Oh, no, there is no Greece as a whole, politically speaking. Just city-states. Sparta is at war with Athens for a sizable part of this period, and other cities lie or don't lie. What happens eventually is that Athens puts together an anti-Spartan alliance called the Delian League, because the treasury was on the island of Delos. And then Athens converts the Delian League into the Athenian Empire, basically, in effect, seizes control of its supposed allies, and I think moves the treasury to Athens, if I remember correctly. And then Athens gets beaten by Sparta, and occupied, and a temporary government of Athenians chosen by the Spartans gets imposed, and the Spartans really aren't up to trying to occupy and rule Athens, and so they go home, and eventually that is removed, and they're back with a more or less democratic system. Yeah?
Was Socrates part of that?
Socrates is in this period. He's...
I thought he was part of the government that Spartans
had. I don't believe so. I don't think that can be right. I could be mistaken. I have to look it up, but I think he's earlier than that. Yeah, I don't think he's one of those, but I'd have to look that up. I don't remember that being the case. In any case, it's... But it's a fascinating system in a whole lot of ways, at least I find it one. Again, we think of a democracy as electing people by majority vote. In what senses was it a democracy? What does majority vote matter for, and how are the politicians selected? Nobody?
Was it just landowning?
No. Oh. Citizens. But what do they get to vote for? It does help to read the book. It's really a very interesting book. That's right. That is, you have essentially a legislature which makes laws and makes other decisions, but the politicians are elected by lot. They're chosen at random. Only exception is the generals. I think they tried that and it didn't work. But other than the generals, from, I think the requirement is that you're 30 years old and be a male Athenian citizen, if I remember correctly. And from that body, they choose the people who will fill the various offices at random, which means that you have a government of amateurs. If you think about, say, the term limitation movement in the U.S., where people argue that it's a problem that we have professional legislators who are congressmen for 30 or 40 years who have no way of being voted out because once you've been in, you've got enough political resources to stay in. If you look in our system, I don't know what the numbers are, but incumbents win, I suppose, 95 to 99% of the elections they're in, a very, very large fraction. Well, this is an extreme version. You may like it or not like it. I mean, it's a very famous society. I think there are things you can say against how it worked. But it's an extreme version because everybody's in for only a year and you don't get to campaign for office because all you got to do is to, in effect, win or lose, as you may look at it, the die roll to do it. So in that sense, it was a very interesting system. But going back for a moment to the business about the deems and the new tribes, what strikes me about it is how modern the proposal feels. It sounds, if you imagine sort of people like Hitler or Stalin or maybe Rousseau with their grand plans for reorganizing the world, It's that kind of a feel, only Solon apparently actually did it, as far as we can tell. Only on the scale of one city-state. All right, so Athens is not just the city of Athens, it's Athens plus Attica, which is the land around Athens, and eventually it's ruling an empire, and I think at some points there are some Athenian colonies outside of Attica itself, but most of Greece is other independent city-states, which sometimes were allied with the Athenians and sometimes were opposed to the Athenians. Yeah?
Well, at that time, you know, Greece was just like the south. It wasn't like, you know, I mean, Greece today goes pretty far north on the Balkan Peninsula, but at the time what they called Greece was just like the Peloponnese and like the area south of the, I forget what the mountains are called, but there's some mountains in central Greece and just below that was
So I guess it would be a question whether you think of Macedonia as part of Greece or not. And my guess is that Philip thought so, but that the Athenians didn't. Yeah, I think so. That's the impression that the Athenians saw the Macedonians as half-barbarians who speak a language that's pretty close to our language. Old-fashioned version of our language, probably. You get the impression, at least in Renault's account, that someone like Alexander sort of identifies with Homer's characters, that Macedon is more like an older version of Greece and more warlike.
He compared himself to Hercules a lot because he thought, it was a myth in his family that they were descended from Hercules.
Well, at least from Renault's version, there was some suspicion that that Alexander had much more immediate divine ancestry. Now, how good Renault's sources for that are, I don't know. She's generally pretty good, but the impression is that Alexander's mother sort of hinted that she had slept with a god, and she was a sort of a weird character by all accounts. But anyway. So, how does prosecution work? Presumably, originally the magistrates are doing prosecution, but then Solon introduces sort of the idea of criminal law in the sense of the idea of cases that any, again, adult male Athenian citizen can prosecute. So you have... It looks as though you start out with something which, like a lot of the systems we've looked at, like the Icelandic system, is a pure civil one where the prosecution has to be instituted by the person who claims to be the victim, to be the victim of a tort, as it were. There are, I think, some hints in the law. I hadn't thought about it until I was rereading stuff recently, which again suggests that in other systems you may have had a preceding feud system because... there's clearly the idea that damages are owed to the heir of the person who's killed, that it's not clear who else can prosecute and so forth. But in any case, once you have Solon's reforms allow a citizen to prosecute not an ordinary tort case, but something like a criminal case, meaning a case thought of as a injury to Athens as a whole, not to a particular person. So that if you think about somebody who runs away in battle or who doesn't enlist in the army when he's required to, draft evader essentially, and a variety of other things. And I actually had a note about that, going back to murder for a moment. Murder is an older... The rules appear to precede Solon's reform. Solon is sort of the reformer thought of as the architect of the legal system. And relative to the victim prosecutes, and in the case of unintentional homicide, it can be pardoned by the kin of the victim. So that, again, sounds a little bit like a feud system where it's a claim by it. Though I don't see evidence that it was actually... You can't tell from this if there was a point at which it was up to him to actually... enforce the rule as well as prosecute. Yeah?
With systems where the family can collect down the blood money, can they execute their own family members?
What happens if the killing is within the family, you're saying?
Right. Or do they have like a mechanism for ordering the execution?
Yeah. I don't know what happens. That's going to mess up the system. And so I... there's something in Islamic law about the case, I think, of a parent who kills his child, and that doesn't fit into the normal capital punishment rules. But I'm not sure I understand how that's being handled, but I think that's not treated as an ordinary murder for some reason, although I don't think it's legal. So I don't really know, and that's obviously a problem in such a system. There is a discussion. Posner actually has an interesting discussion in one of his chapters, I think, or essays, of one of the Greek plays. Some of you may remember which one it is, where one of the kings who's in the Trojan expedition comes home and is murdered by his wife and her lover. What? Agamemnon, right. Which? And is that Clytemnestra, or am I confusing different people? I'm no good on... But in any case, the point that Posner makes is, what's to be done about it? Well, at that time, it really is a feud system in the sense that it's up to the kin to avenge it, which means that it's up to his son to do something about it. There is no equivalent of calling the police. And so that means that the son ends up, I think, killing his mother, doesn't he? Is that right? Yeah, that's right. Which is itself considered an offense, as it were. And then he's the one who's getting executed, and his sister is in the next play, I think. Is that right?
There's a trial at the end of the first play.
Yeah.
Where they actually have a jury. And I know the jury's all men, too, except for Athena, because she was supposedly born just as she was
right.
And then the second play focuses on the sister, Electra.
Right. And
the wife was by Master.
Right. It was right. So, but in any case, the point that Posner is just making is that, unlike a modern system, there isn't a state enforcement for it. It's all by private action. I'm looking at the wrong thing here. Sorry. Just a minute. There's something. One moment. There's something in here that I thought I had, but I am in the wrong place. Yeah, there we are. Anyway, so the prosecution, it looks as though in the time we're looking at, the magistrates mostly get involved only for minor offenses, that for sort of disorderly conduct at something the magistrate is running, he can impose a fine, and if you don't think the fine is legitimate, you don't pay it, and then you're prosecuted for not paying the money, and then you argue you didn't know the fine. But normally that one automatically is just a fine without a trial otherwise. But then the private cases are prosecuted by the claimant, who, if he wins the case, obviously gets the equivalent of a damage payment, and the public cases are prosecuted by anyone. And then the question is, why bother to prosecute? And this is sort of one of the issues that runs through a lot of our cases. What's the incentive to prosecute? And the answer is that there are at least two incentives. One of them is that in many of the cases, in many of the cases, many categories of case, the prosecutor gets part of the fine, something like half of the fine that's due, paid by, assuming he wins the case. In addition to that, it's pretty clear if you read the orations and stuff that there was a lot of pretty vicious political infighting going on in that society, so you might prosecute somebody just because he was an enemy of yours. There is, in fact, a case where, if I remember correctly, I think it's Demosthenes, has been voted a gold crown for services to Athens. And so some of his enemies prosecute whoever did it on the grounds that Demosthenes didn't serve Athens and therefore didn't deserve a gold crown. So that would be a fairly extreme case of a political case. And then the third reason, possible reason, I would conjecture, as in some of the other systems, is to extort an out-of-court settlement. That if I think I can have a chance of getting you convicted of something, you might be willing to do me nice things to me for not doing it. And in that system, as in the English system, this was illegal. this is compounding a felony in 18th century England, and I don't remember what it's called in Athens. How, in principle, if I start a prosecution and then don't show up, I can myself be prosecuted and punished for that. On the other hand, it looks as though if I start a prosecution, I then postpone it, maybe by joint agreement with the defendant, and we never show up, nothing may happen. So at least it sounds from the comments here as though there are ways of evading the rule. Yeah.
So now, but in Athens, if you were convicted of, like, you know, like Sam being prosecuted for homicide by a relative, you know, if I was convicted, I would only pay a fine. I wouldn't be executed, right?
Huh, depends on... No, if I am prosecuted for homicide, and it's intentional homicide, then I can be executed. However, I've got the option after the first day of the trial of choosing exile instead of leaving.
Okay.
I think that's the answer.
I was wondering, I mean, if the result of a criminal trial and you pay damages to the victim or their survivors...
The result of the criminal is normal in most cases. Remember, homicide is not part of the criminal civil system.
Mm-hmm.
Homicide is a leftover from earlier legal rules. Mm-hmm. For any other public case, which is criminal is the closest I think we can come to the equivalent, the normal result is you owe a fine. The fine is owed to the state, but the state then gives part of that fine to the prosecutor.
Oh, part of the prosecutor.
So it's not that the prosecutor is claiming it himself. And similarly, if there's a case which says that you're holding property that belongs to Athens, the prosecutor gets, I think, half of that property for a successful prosecution. One thing which I don't think is ever made clear here is what would happen if two people wanted to prosecute the same case, how you would allocate it. And maybe it's just first come, first serve, but I don't think the book, at least I don't remember the book ever discussing that issue, which if you imagine cases where it's profitable is obviously a real issue. But then there's obviously a risk in this system, and it's a risk that we worry about in our system too, and that is that you may target people who have lots of money and are unpopular whether or not they've actually done anything wrong. All right? And given that their system, it's a jury trial with a jury of several hundred people, the rule, there are no real rules limiting what you can say or argue. They're pretty clearly illegitimate. It's considered appropriate to make all sorts of rhetorical arguments. The defendant can have his small children with him in court, so people will feel sympathy for him. What will happen to these kids if I lose this case and get exiled or whatever? You do not have a lawyer. You can yield some of your time to a friend to testify for you. Witness testimony is all in writing. All the witness does is come and say, yes, this is indeed is my testimony. And it's not clear, it's clear that there is a risk that you could use these criminal prosecutions either in the hope of convicting somebody or being paid to leave them alone. So how do they prevent that? How do they discourage that?
The
Athenians. How do they discourage abusive prosecution? This is an issue we worry about in our civil system, right? We worry that you will sue a class action or punitive damages, somebody who really, yeah.
There was a punishment if you didn't get enough votes.
That's right. You have to get at least 20% of the votes in this big jury. And if you don't get that, you owe a fine, fairly sizable fine. I think it works out to about 3 years' salary for an ordinary working person. In addition to that, you could be charged, I think, at the end of the year with being a sycophant. With sycophant, to them, meant somebody who engaged in abusive prosecution. Presumably, if you're... I'm not sure what the punishment for that is. If you don't get your 20%, probably you not only get fined, you can never prosecute that kind of case again. And we don't know much about the sycophant. They could only prosecute three Athenians and three medics in a year for sycophancy. So I don't know again how they allocate it. What if more than three people wanted them?
So how many votes do you need for like a verdict? Like three? Like
majority.
Majority. And like, you know, so let's say I get like a huge majority. Do I get more damages based on those?
As far as I can tell, I don't think so. No, as far as I can tell, there is a fine for getting less than 20%, and then between 20 and 50, you just lose the case, and beyond 50%, you win.
In the online chapter from your book, there's a thing on wages at the end. Yep. Who pays the wages of the jurors? The state?
The state. Yeah. As I suggest, I think that looks as though it was partly a welfare system, that the juror's wage is about half the wage of a rower on a ship. So it's a low but not vanishingly low wage. And it looks like a noticeable fraction of the population at any one time were jurors. I've got some calculations there which give sort of a very rough estimate. We don't know how big the population was. But I think we know how many jurors there were. I think that's in the record. So it could be that, 10 or 20% of the population were jurors. And you get the feeling that this whole business of litigation was almost an entertainment industry for them, as it were, as though lots of people are watching and participating and interested in it and so forth.
So citizens could volunteer for jury duty. I assume, wealthy litigants must have hired jurors to take their side.
How do you hire a juror?
So you say, I'll pay you and you volunteer for jury duty in my trial.
You don't volunteer for jury duty in my trial. You volunteer to be part of a panel for juries for the year.
And
they have very elaborate mechanisms to try to make sure that you will not know which case you're a juror for until the very last minute. There apparently were various scandals in which it turned out jurors have been bribed, because sometimes the sums of, this is a society with quite large wealth inequalities, and sometimes the sums at stake were large and the jurors were poor. And so they set up, they have basically machinery, physical machines giving, I think, discs that come out sort of, and the book goes into it in detail, but there's a fairly elaborate procedure which is used sort of each day to sort people to courts and to cases. And pretty clearly the design of it is trying to make sure that you don't know who will be your jurors until the case starts, by which time they've been separated from you and you have no way of getting out of the bribe.
Now, was there like mandatory jury duty? Were there any non-volunteers?
I don't think so, but I am not certain. Again, you have the same book I do, and you can go look it up. But I don't remember there being required jury duty, but I could be wrong. So basically that's the solution for the criminal cases. For the private cases, we don't know as much, but for the private cases, for at least some categories of private cases, the losing plaintiff owed a sixth of the amount he had claimed to the prevailing defendant. And I find that an intriguing idea, because if you think about a tort case in general, imagine for a moment that litigation costs are not very high, which they probably weren't in that system because you don't have any lawyers, and that you know that the system doesn't work perfectly. All right? It looks as though it always pays to sue. Right? There's some chance you'll win. Heads I win, tails you break even. And that means that it makes a lot of sense to say that when I'm suing you, I'm imposing a risk of your own paying me money you don't owe, and therefore, when the court decides you don't owe it, I ought to owe you damages. Right. And if you're curious enough, if you go to my webpage and follow the link to my current drafts, I've got an article which is discussing the current problem of patent trolls, which some of you have probably heard about. And the argument I make is that you can look at current infringement litigation as rather like a feud system. That is to say, on the face of it, it would always pay Apple to sue Samsung, whether or not they had a strong case. Because if Apple sues Samsung claiming that the Samsung phones infringe their patents, that'll make people less willing to buy Samsung phones until the case is resolved. Just as if you think about Iceland, you would say, well, it always pays me to rob you, assuming I've got the physical force to get away with it. Why don't I? Because somebody will come after me. Well, what might limit Apple's willingness to sue on a bad case? Samsung can sue them on a bad case, too. And if Apple sues Samsung sues Apple, not only do they have to pay lawyers, they both are weakened against the other phone manufacturers because everybody's afraid who might win it. So that means that you can think of it as something like a feud system in which your willingness to attack other people is restricted by the threat that they will then counterattack you. All right? However, the patent trolls are non-practicing entities. These are firms that own patents but don't use them. they own patents, which they have only in order to license them, or to sue people for not licensing them. Well, that means that they are immune to counterattacks. All right? If you're not practicing your patent, you can't be sued for infringing. Consequently, if a non-practicing entity sues your company, you can decide whether to settle, you can decide to try to fight the suit, but you don't have the option of punishing them by suing them. Make sense so far? Yes, no? Well, if litigation costs were low, it would always pay to sue as long as there's any chance at all of winning. And in fact, people worry that this happens a lot. Now, you might say litigation costs aren't low, but that's assuming the case goes to court. All right, you've got a company. Your product depends on something which they claim infringes their patent. If they win the case, you're out of business. But they don't want you to be out of business. They just want you to pay a licensing fee. All right. So it looks like a case where they're in a good position to extort as long as there's any non-zero chance that the court will decide that they're in the right. All right. So, which is why I suggested in this draft of mine that having analyzed it in terms of the legal system of Saga period Iceland, we can now solve it in terms of the legal system of Pericles and Athens by introducing their rule that the losing plaintiff owes damages. Because settling out of court looks less tempting if you know that while it's true there's a risk of you losing your company, there's also a chance that you're making a lot of money and you think you're going to because you think you have a strong case if they lose the case. So that strikes me sort of an intriguing way of analyzing.
The policy consideration for the reason we don't have something like that, of course there's a cause of action for malicious prosecution and things like that when they're egregious.
Yes.
But our concern is that we don't want to deny access to the courts to people. We don't want them to be afraid of bringing a cause of action before a court. And that's why they...
I understand, but we also don't want people to sue on bad cases.
Right.
And the question is sort of what's the trade-off between those...
Right.
Those considerations.
Of course. And I totally understand.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
I understand. No, obviously, we don't. That is, I'm introducing the idea for the particular case of patent litigation, but of course, the logic of my argument applies quite generally.
Mm-hmm.
So that what I'm really proposing is a radical revision of the tort system.
Right.
In which what I'm imagining, I'm not sure it's a good idea, but I think it's an interesting idea, would be two features from the Athenian. One of them is the damages, and one of them is making them proportional to the amount claimed.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in fact, you people can probably tell me more clearly than I know. I sue you.
Mm-hmm.
I make an argument for how much money I say you owe me. The jury could award more than that, couldn't it?
No.
It can't.
No, that's why complaints typically have three or four times what
people
actually expect.
So the complaint has to specify. Fine. So then, if we believe that having you claim more than you really think you're entitled to is a bad idea, then we use the Athenian idea of saying that the damages you owe when you lose your tort case are proportioned to your claim. And now you've got an incentive not to claim more than you think you have a reasonable chance of getting, because if you lose, it's going to be expensive. So that's my radical proposal for reforming tort law. And as I say, I don't think I'm confident to say if it's a good idea, but I think it's an interesting idea.
It's certainly interesting. The only problem is that we do have built-in mechanisms for dismissal and summary judgment and various stages throughout the trial where the case can be, if it doesn't have merit, can be tossed out. And also there's a huge discovery cost. Which, when you're taking on a big company, can put you as a plaintiff at a tremendous disadvantage because they can just bury you in those costs to produce the information that you need to prosecute your case. So that kind of creates a problem. And then also, when you're doing a civil case, you're going to an attorney, and 9 times out of 10, it's on a contingent fee basis, and the attorney's not going to assume those costs, which will be sizable, especially when you have expert witnesses involved, if the attorney doesn't believe that the case has merit, because they only get paid if you win.
Except one of the questions is how many of the cases actually go to trial.
Not very many.
But my point is that if the other side has reason to be afraid of losing, then you may do an out-of-court settlement, which then eliminates most of those costs. The case I was initially thinking of was in the patent litigation case,
mm-hmm.
where I don't think many of them go to court, And that means you are close to a zero litigation cost world, and in a zero litigation cost world, it always pays to sue. That's
definitely.
But one of the things I'm wondering, I see a lot of this depends on how reliable you think the court system is, on how well you can predict verdicts. Has anybody ever tried to actually measure how that's changed over time? Because there's a lot of inertia in the legal system, and I'm wondering if perhaps rules that made sense 100 years ago might not make sense now.
Well, with jury instructions, at least for jury trials, I know that I haven't seen an extensive amount of jury trials, but I have seen quite a few. And you can usually, everything I've heard is that juries are really good at sniffing out BS. And that's what I've seen to be true for the most part, and what I've personally observed. So, I don't know, in that sense it's reliable, but also because of a lot of procedural...
But if you think about patent litigation, BS isn't very well defined in a sense. That is, it's the question of whether something infringes usually really is a complicated question.
Right. And you've got these experts that are just, oh my God, I watched a patent infringement case and it was a pharmaceutical case and I couldn't understand a damn thing that the scientists were talking about because it's so complex.
And but then the jury also can't understand.
Exactly. And I wonder, if this was actually a bench trial, so there was no jury, but I just...
But the other thing in terms of changes is that I believe both class actions and punitive damages are, for most purposes, a modern development. That is, punitive damages, you've got a few very early cases in English common law. But I know at least as late as the 19th century, one of the couple of major commenters believed there was no such thing, that it was a misunderstanding of damages for non-pecuniary damages.
Right.
That's still the position, I think, in New Hampshire. I believe New Hampshire still does not have punitive damages, if I remember correctly.
We limit them in California, too. A lot of states actually limit non-economic awards of damages because of successful lobbying by insurance companies.
But non-economic or punitive, those aren't the same thing.
Both. Punitive and non-economic. Right. And, like, in Washington State, where I'm from, there's no cap on punitive damages in medical malpractice, but there is on non-economic. And then in California, there's a cap on both, I believe. There's a cap on non-economic damages, which would be pain and suffering, and then also on punitive damages, too, to limit exposure.
But now, no state, as far as I know, has damages for the actual value of your life to yourself.
No. Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
What are called hedonic damages. Think about a tortious loss of life case.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I believe it is the case that under traditional common law, if I am at fault and you die as a result, I owe no damages because your claim dies with you.
Because you're gone, yeah.
That under statute law, starting, I think, at the 19th century, you have survivor statutes.
Mm-hmm.
Which say that I owe money, but I owe money to your survivors, not for the cost to you of dying, but for the cost to them of dying.
For me dying, the cost to them of...
You're dying.
Right.
That's right. But that assumes that the value of your life to you is zero.
Right.
That your only value is to other people. That's crazy.
And, well, it is crazy, but if there's no one to... If there's no one that has standing to sue in a tort cause of action for wrongful death, there's no suit.
I have a simple solution to this problem, too.
Yeah.
And that is that you now living have a inchoate tort claim. That is to say, you know that you would have a tort claim if somebody wrongfully killed you. That inchoate tort claim could be marketable.
Oh, sell it.
In which case you transfer that. You may transfer it. You go to your heirs if you've got heirs. Notice that under current law, even if you've got an heir, still the part of the claim that's for the value of your life to you vanishes.
Right.
That the heir only has a claim because you're useful to him. You might not be useful to the heir. Right? Maybe you're retired and not earning any money for anybody.
Right. Right.
So my claim is that you ought to be, this goes back to the Iceland, this is one of my cases of getting ideas from the historical systems that we might use.
Yeah.
And in the historical system, actual tort claims are entirely marketable. And I'm suggesting you take that one step further and make inchoate tort claims marketable. You then sell them in advance. That is part of the, looking at it as an economist for a moment, think about the whole question of what's the value of life.
Right.
How much is your life worth to you?
Right, a lot more than it would be.
But not an infinite amount. But it seems like an infinite amount. Because if somebody says to you, I'd really like a heart, would you sell me mine, yours? There's no price you'll accept. But the reason you won't accept a price for your heart is not that your life is infinitely valuable. It's that money is worthless to a corpse. So that it's a dividing by zero problem, not a multiplying by infinity, if you think about it.
Okay.
Because after all, you do in practice sell your life every day. That is, you make decisions. You decide whether to spend money on seeing the doctor an extra time, on getting your brakes checked, on all sorts of things. Where you are implicitly making a trade-off of some very, very small chance of losing your life versus other values.
Right.
And you can think in terms of those of an actual value, that you value your life at $1 million or at $5 million or at something like that, which if you're behaving consistently, which maybe you're not because we're not all perfect on that, and these are low probability things, if you're behaving consistently, you say, yes, his revealed preference for his life, judged by what risks he will or won't take at what cost, is $5 million.
Right.
And if the way we did it was that you could sell your inchoate claim in advance, then instead of getting $5 million when you die, you'd get $500 now, assuming that you've got a 1 in 10,000 chance of death, of
right.
such a death.
Right.
The $500 now you can spend now and money is useful to you.
Right.
So that would get you back into a world where you could actually be compensated for being killed, not compensated after the fact when you're really killed, but compensated before the fact for the risk of being killed.
It would be based on some complex system that insurance companies use now to calculate how likely it is that your death will be the result of an accident.
That's right. And you'd have to have some mechanism for getting the value of life, which given our legal system would probably be the same amount for everybody, although in fact happy people probably value lives more than miserable people.
Mm-hmm.
I, in fact, had one friend who told me that she was not sure that the present value of utility at birth was positive. She wasn't sure she wouldn't rather never have been born. But, and yet she ended up on the Council of Economic Advisors. She's now, I think, happily married, but this is somebody who was a colleague of mine a long time ago who, I think, had a child when she was 15 or so, 16, but ended up as a professor at a good university and having a successful career as an economist, interestingly.
It's interesting, that whole theory, the economic theory behind that is interesting. It's just from a trying to sell that to
yes.
the public at large would be
difficult. Yes. Yeah. But then I only have to sell it to economists.
Exactly. preaching to the choir there.
So to speak. Yeah. Other features of the system, you could challenge your opponent to take an oath. It was not legally required, as in some of the other systems we've looked at, but you could then introduce as evidence to the jury the fact that he was not willing to swear an oath. And just as, I guess, we can introduce some to the jury the fact that you aren't willing to testify, can't we, or not?
The Fifth Amendment protects it from that.
So, but can we tell the jury that you took the Fifth?
No.
I
mean,
no.
It doesn't come up. It's not really useful. If you don't put a witness up there and ask the witness whether the defendant was taking the Fifth or not.
At any point in the trial.
I think can they say in closing arguments? There's more of a leeway with closing arguments, but yeah, I don't think they can even mention that. Because it's a built-in protection.
One of the sort of interesting feature of the system is how you deal with the question whether the testimony is true or not. Because the testimony is in writing, so you can't cross-examine the witnesses. What you can do is to prosecute the witness for false testimony.
In a separate action?
In a separate action where, if I understand the sequence correctly, what I think happens is that your initial action goes through. If there's a fine, you pay it, but if there's a punishment, you don't suffer it. Then the separate action for false testimony is completed. And I think if it's found false testimony, he may have to pay your fine. And I'm not sure if you can then be tried again without the testimony or not. But it's
like civil perjury, basically.
Is there civil perjury?
No.
There isn't. Because I was thinking that if you think about all systems have this problem. All right. How do you? Part of the way we do it is cross examination.
Mm-hmm.
And in their system, they can cross examine the plaintiff and the defendant, but they can't cross examine the witnesses. On the other hand, in our system, I, as a civil party, don't have anything that I can do to punish you for lying under oath. The DA can punish you.
Oh,
but I can't. That's right. I can't commence a I can't sue you, I don't think. I don't think there's any way, even if I can prove that you lied, I don't think there's any way that I can sue you for lying in my case. Yeah, but your lie doesn't have to be defamation. Your lie could just be a statement of fact that wasn't true, which led the jury to reach a conclusion. Suppose the question is whether or not, suppose somebody was injured, it's argued that I was liable for making a defective product, it's also argued that he was contributorily negligent or had assumed risk or something. The witness claims to show that he didn't assume the risk, which isn't true, we will suppose. That's not defaming me,
right. But
it's losing me the case.
Right, right.
So it did strike me that sort of, in one way, their system seems worse than ours and that you can't cross-examine the witness, and yet the fact that you can take an action which doesn't depend on a third party prosecuting strikes me in some sense as attractive. Maybe we should introduce a civil perjury action. I don't know if you could or not, but it would be an interesting thought in terms of what we have. One of the interesting features which shows up not only in Athenian law but in Roman law is that slaves can only give testimony under torture. All right. Why do you think they have such a rule? Yeah?
I thought maybe the slaves could be trusted.
Because?
Different loyalties and...
My guess is that what's going on is that the most likely case where you want a slave's testimony is against his master. Right? The slave's in the master's household. He's likely to observe things. But the master's got all sorts of ways of punishing the slave. So he might be emotionally loyal even if he isn't. He testifies against the master, assuming the master is still around afterwards, depending on what the case is. The master can beat him. He's free to do that. He can't kill him, but he can beat him. He can, you know, treat him very badly in various ways. So you need some counter pressure to make him testify. I think, what's the obvious argument against testimony under torture?
What? Everyone would say anything.
Yeah, that's right. So that's a real problem, right? And this is not a problem that didn't occur to them. That one of the funniest things that I discovered when reading up on this are two orations discussing the question of testimony of slaves under torture. And in one of them, the oration is in favor of somebody who wants this testimony to be believed. And the oration says, there's never been a case when slave testimony under torture turned out to be untrue. It's a perfectly reliable method. The other is an oration where the party in question wanted it not believed. And he made exactly your argument that the slave will say whatever you want him to say in order not to be tortured. The two orations were written by the same orator. That was what I thought was really neat. So they're aware of the argument, yeah?
I had a question.
Yep.
So with only being able to testify under torture,
yes,
would that be that they came to you first with the information, and then if they still said it while you were torturing them, then it's true?
What seems to be happening is that the plaintiff is asking the slave owner's permission to torture his slave. I think cannot torture him without the slave owner's permission, but can introduce into the case the fact that the slave owner refused to give permission. And I think, though I am not sure, that the plaintiff owes damage payments to the slave owner if the slave is permanently injured. I think that's the case that I've got. Right? Slave's property from their standpoint. And so then the question is, what's the answer? That is, why does anybody do such a... We understand why they do it. The question is, why do they believe it? Why is it of any use? And the one possible clue is that yet another legal system, one which we're not covering, but the student paper covered in a previous year, and that's the Visigothic legal system. The Visigoths are the Germanic tribe that end up ruling Spain after the Romans and before the Muslims take over Spain, basically. And Visigothic law has a provision in which if you're accused of an offense and the jury decides that they, or the judge, I think, I don't think it's a jury, I think the judge decides there's not enough evidence to either convict or acquit, you can be tortured. But before you can be tortured, the accuser has got to give a detailed account of the facts of the crime. And if your confession does not match those facts, it's not accepted. And the accuser is then held guilty, I don't remember the punishment, but there's some guilty false accusation. And if the accuser has published, has told people the facts of the crime, you can't be tortured. So it's a mechanism to try to test whether the confession is real or is just done because of the torture. by seeing whether you are showing that you know something that you wouldn't have known unless you were guilty. Do we do the same thing?
I'm not sure I followed the whole thing.
The mechanism is, you are suspected of killing her.
Okay.
We aren't sure if you're guilty or not. I accused you of doing it. I claim I saw it. I tell the judge, here is what happened. This is the detailed account. This is where it happened. He pulled out a sword and stabbed her. It was after an argument, etc., etc. I have told nobody else. I only told the judge. They now torture you. If your confession is, yes, I got him in an argument with her, I pulled out a sword, etc., aha, confession is true, you're convicted.
So it's corroborated.
That's
he
right.
He has similar tactics, the police, withholding certain elements of a crime that only the killer would know.
That's right. That is to say, in our system, we don't literally call it torture, but we've got ways of trying to pressure people to confess in various ways, whether plea bargaining or long interrogations or whatever. And in theory, part of the reason we believe the confession is that it reveals information that he otherwise wouldn't have known. What's the problem? What's the hole in this system for us and maybe for the Visigoths?
Well, for Visigoths, I guess.
How about for us? You're a policeman. Mm-hmm. You believe the guy's guilty. So what do you do? You've got ways of pressuring
him. Right, you
cook up a tip.
You leak. Well, but one thing you can do is you tell him, with nobody listening, the facts of
what
it.
What he needs to say. Yeah, and exactly. You implant the testimony
that
you need him to give.
That's right.
For the confession.
And so you have to worry. All of the, in a sense, one of the things that a lot of these rules hinge on is who you can trust. If you can trust the judge and the police, so to speak, then certain things work. If you can trust the judge and not the police, other things work. If you can trust it, and so forth, and so on. And that sort of runs through, it seems to me, all of our discussion of thinking about these systems.
With the Visigothic system, yep. That I kind of think that makes sense to charge the accuser, because then if they know all of the details, then it is likely that they...
Well, except that what they know doesn't have to be true.
That's true.
Right. That is, they have to have some basis for accusing, so they've got to... If their story is true, they'll know some things. You don't know what they are. You don't know what they... But I just thought it was interesting that sort of your first reaction when you hear about the Greeks and their own doings is, weren't they stupid? But we know that they thought about the problem. And in the Visigothic case, at least we know they had a solution. My guess of what's going with the Greeks and Romans, though I don't know, is that they believe that a good interrogator can tell whether you're lying. That the good interrogator can recognize the point at which... Either you would have told the truth to get out of it, but you're just making up things, and, you know, if you're being tortured, you probably aren't thinking very clearly. And so I don't know if they're right or not, but, you know, we sort of take for granted that torture makes no sense, but then we don't like torture. It's an ugly arrangement, and probably one that is sensible for us not to allow in our legal system. But given that they do, they presumably have tried to think through how to make it work.
Well, in the history, just the fact that torture lasted for so long, it had to have served some purpose.
Yes, but of course it might have served, you can think of purposes it could serve other than finding truth.
Exactly.
That one function, after all, is to get people to accuse other people. And there's, if you want to read a modern story of sort of enormous scale miscarriages of justice, there is a book called Conspiracy of Silence, which is written by an Austrian communist, a physicist, in fact, who gets caught up in the Great Purge in Russia. I don't know how many of you know anything about the Great Purge in Russia, but Stalin arrested and imprisoned some millions of people, a fair number of whom ended up dead, not all of them. And this guy was a physicist, Austrian communist, comes into the Soviet Union, presumably as a supporter, gets accused for some reason, spends, I think, several years going through the prisons, and he's an intellectual. He's sort of paying attention. He's keeping track of it all, and he's writing a book about the experience. And it's really interesting. By his account, you have prisons that were built in the by the czars for a cell to hold one person. Under the czars, they got overcrowded at 3. During the Great Purge, they'll have 20 or 30 people crowded into the single cell, packed solidly. One of his, he isn't sure what happened. He isn't sure why it happens. And one of his theories, one of his conjectures, is that it was a self-sustaining system. That what happens is that you arrest one person. In order to prove that he's really confessed, and you're willing to do a lot of nasty things to him to make him confess, he's got to name his fellow conspirators. Well, if he didn't really commit anything, he's got to make up some names. Now you're the policeman. You've been told these people are fellow conspirators. If you don't go arrest them, you're going to get in trouble. So it just expands out like that. And a number of the things, by his account, sometimes the interrogator ends up in the cell, like a year later or 2 years later as the system goes on. And he tells the story of one man who was the head of, who was a physician, and he was the head of the doctor's organization in his city. And he had a very good memory. So when they demanded to know who were his fellow conspirators, he gave a list of every doctor in the city. And they weren't willing to arrest every doctor in the city. And they said, well, who are the important ones? And I was the head, everybody else was equal. And so they eventually let him off with just, you know, sending him to prison, but not making him confess to anybody else. So anyway, it's quite a fascinating story.
What are you holding
him? Conspiracy of Silence. And one possibility is that Solon was deliberately trying to sort of wipe out the old educated class in order to make it easier for him to reinvent history, so to speak. See, part of what's going on, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the history, is that Stalin is getting rid of all of his rivals. So that you've got a series of show trials in which people who were other leading revolutionaries in the original period of the Russian Revolution confess to having been Nazi agents or counter-revolutionaries or all sorts of things, and are executed. And in which people in the West pretend to believe in it. Some of them maybe really do believe in it. It's hard to know. One of the stories that the guy tells in the book is that his interrogator has an account by someone else who has confessed and implicated him. And the account describes how this Austrian, on the train coming into Russia in, I don't know when it's supposed to be, 1930 or something, roughly 1930, approaches the other guy and tries to recruit him into the Nazi secret police to spy on Russia. And so the guy who's being accused says to the policeman, look, you're a policeman. How likely is it, do you think, that one of our agents going into spy in Russia, to spy in Germany, would go up to a stranger and try to recruit him? Wouldn't that be sort of a stupid thing to do? Well, that's what the testimony says. How likely is it that if he went up to the venue, it would just turn out that he was already an agent, which is what this guy claimed to be? Yeah, that's what the time this is supposed to happen is 2 years before Hitler takes power. Whole story is impossible. But the policeman can't admit that he doesn't believe it without himself getting in trouble. So anyway, it's quite a fascinating book about sort of maybe the largest semi-deliberate miscarriage of justice that we know of in history. But to get back to Athens. Let me say a bit about marriage institutions, which are pretty amazing and pretty interesting. You've got the term kyrios, which is, I think, the same word that you get kyrie, which shows up in religious songs, kyrie eleison, meaning the Lord. But in the Athenian context, the kyrios is your Lord. So that if you're a child, your kyrios is almost certainly your father or your grandfather if your father is dead. If you are a woman, your kyrios is initially your father, until you get married, at which point your kyrios... Just a minute. I was going to play you a bit of music, but I think this may not be working. I don't want to do that. Yeah. There we are. Just a minute, and I'll find it. Here's what I want. I thought it would. No. I don't have it. There's a Joan Baez song, "Oh, hard is the lot of all womankind. She's always controlled, she's always confined, controlled by her father until she's a wife, a slave to her husband the rest of her life." And that applies more accurately probably to Periclean Athens than to the society where it's being described. So your Kyriosis is your lord, and he is the person who is legally responsible for you. If you're a child, it is your Kyriosis' duty to feed you and take care of you, but also you've got to obey his orders. He will represent you in court. If you're an adult unmarried woman, your father is in that same relationship. If you're an adult married woman, your husband is in that relationship. In addition to that, you've got the category of oikos, which is roughly household. And an oikos has a kyrios, but he doesn't have to be the same person as the kyrios of any particular person in the household. So the household, in effect, my children don't inherit my property till I die. So the land and the house belong to me, even if I've got adult children living there. If I have an adult son who is married, I am the kyrios of the household, but he is the kyrios of his wife. And I am not the kyrios of my son. That is, I am the kyrios of the household my son is a part of, but once he's 18, he's legally independent. Only when I die do my sons end up establishing their own oike, their own household, at which point they are now kyrios over that household as well as over their wives and children. Does that make sense? So it's a interesting system, and one in which women are never legally independent. A man can divorce his wife by simply sending her back, presumably to her father. It's not clear whether a woman can freely divorce her husband or not. That clearly a woman can divorce her husband, but she's supposed to, in effect, register the divorce to a particular official, and some people argue the official might refuse if the husband objects. We don't know. When a woman is married, she normally goes with a dowry. The dowry is hers. The husband can treat it as capital, but isn't supposed to spend it. If he divorces her, he's got to give it back. If he dies and she has no son, she and the dowry go back to her father. Or to her brother if her father has died. That is her father's heir. So that the woman is always in an oikos. Normally, it's the oikos of her father if she's not married, her husband if she's married, or it could be her son if she is a widow but has a son, because he is now the male head of the household. So you always have a male head of the household. A woman is always a member of such a household. And if I've got it right, I think the only situation where she has any choice over the matter is if her husband dies and she can choose either to stay in the household of her husband's heir, who I guess might or might not be her own son, or to go back to the household of her father's heir. But other than that, she's got no choice at all, which is a little bit strange. One of the other parts of that I also thought was sort of weird, but in its own way neat, is that both seduction and rape are crimes, but seduction is a worse crime than rape. Do you see why? From whose point of view is seduction a worse crime than rape? The husband's, that's right. Because seduction means not only that his wife might be pregnant by somebody else, but that he can't trust her.
We have a cause of action in court for that.
Describe.
That's the alienation of
affections. Mm-hmm. Right. But of course, it isn't a felony.
No.
Whereas in their case, if I understand correctly, if the husband catches a man having sex with his wife, in either case, he can kill him. I don't think he can kill the wife. I think if the wife has been seduced, he's got to divorce her. I don't think that's true if she's been raped. But the husband can also seize the seducer and basically mistreat him until he buys his way out. I don't think there is any criminal action for it. I think there's a damage payment for seduction. Pretty sure that's right. Or for rape, but a larger one for seduction. And of course for the husband. So the whole thing, the husband is, you know, it's a more extreme case. If you take the famous line of Blackstone's that in law, husband and wife are one person and that person is the husband. This is a more extreme case because they aren't really even thinking of the one person. They're thinking of the husband. It's true the wife only has some rights. I mean, I think if you'd killed her, that would be a crime of murder. But the wife has to be represented in court by her husband. The one exception to all of this, apparently, is that a woman who is a metic and not a citizen can be her own lord, her own Kyrie. She still has to have a citizen who represents her, because I think every metic, I believe, has to have a citizen sponsor. But she does not have to have a husband or father who is her lord. I've got that correct, which I thought was also sort of intriguing in terms of how that system worked. Another part of the whole system, I find that you've stolen my property and I can prove it. I get the property back plus twice its value. What is the obvious way in which I demonstrate that you've stolen my property?
Reduce it from the first itself.
What is the obvious risk of this?
That you'll plant it.
What is the modern equivalent of this problem?
That you'll wrongfully testify.
No, I was thinking of the modern equivalent is the policeman who plants drugs in order to justify an arrest. All right. What is the Athenian solution to this? You read it.
You told us.
I did tell you. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I just thought it was.
You can search the house naked.
That's right. You can search the house if you've got to do it stark naked. But you see why I think it's fun. I mean, these are people who really were different from us, and they were very smart people, and they've got lots of clever ideas. Some would sound crazy. And yet, you know, that one makes perfectly good sense, given a society that doesn't have any reason to be, which as far as I can know, their society didn't, which on the whole seems more sensible than ours. I gather that one of the East Coast elite colleges is having a nudity week in which they're doing all sorts of events which are celebrating nudity in order to get people out of the prejudice against nudity.
It's interesting because we all have the same problems. It's just that people come up, based on their culture and what their mores are, they come up with different solutions.
That's right. And one of the interesting questions is what's going on that our solutions are properly designed for our environment and theirs for theirs? Or is it that we're just thinking in different ways and coming up with different approaches? And that's sort of, I mean, I would like to believe that something analogous to a feud system could function in a modern society for various reasons. I don't like centralized governments. It'd be nice if you could do without it. I might be right, I might be wrong. I don't know. And similarly the other way around, to what extent could something like a modern system function under the physical circumstances of Athens or of Iceland or of any of these earlier systems? It's not clear whether it could or not. Let me go back a minute to a different feature of the system, because there are a bunch of interesting features of this system, and that's the political system, that by its own standards, Athens was presumably unusual in not having a king. Athens had the royal dynasty early on. If you believe Renault, at least, at one point earlier than this, but later than that, it had a tyrant, that is to say, a popular dictator. And it then goes to this system. What are the... You're an Athenian and you want to argue in favor of Athenian institutions, including selecting people by lot. And what do you say... What are the problems you're trying to avoid?
I want everyone's vote to be equal.
Why do you care?
And freely given.
Yeah, you don't believe in that stuff. You've got all these metics and slaves around, and women as well. You don't believe in equality.
Well,
what's this nonsense?
No, but when we say person, we're talking about...
male Athenian citizens.
Yeah, exactly. Because everyone else doesn't count.
But why might you say it's a better system? What are the dangers, after all, of the system you people have? You people have a system where you elect people by how many votes they can get. What's likely to happen in that system? We don't really like tyrants, and we don't really like kings. What might your system easily morph into, yo?
Some sort of dynasty.
That's right. Take a look at our system. We had two Adams who were presidents, fairly close together. We had two Roosevelts who were president, I think uncle, nephew, if I remember correctly. We've had two Bushes who were presidents. We may yet have two Clintons who were presidents. We had three Kennedys, who among them were a president, two senators, and a...
Supreme Court justice.
No, none of those Kennedys, I don't think, was ever on the Supreme Court, but one of them was attorney general. Right. So you might legitimately worry if you really see something like a monarchy or an oligarchy as a serious threat. You say any system in which people do stuff that gets them elected. Once they get elected, they have power. They can do favors for people. They can get bribes. They can get more resources. They can accumulate influence. this is going to keep going. We've got a solution to it. So it seems to me it's an interesting, yep.
I don't think my questions are, like, too far.
That's all right. I like far out questions.
Like, the framers.
Yes.
What were they thinking of? I mean, obviously, they thought about that, so.
How did they try to prevent that? Well, they tried to, I think they wanted not to have political parties. I believe the view of the founders was political parties, alien factions, were a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure they had any good mechanism for preventing them. And, of course, the original scheme was different in a bunch of ways. As you may know, the vice president and the president didn't run together. The vice president was the guy who came in second in the election, essentially. So that would tend to give you a president and vice president of opposite factions insofar as you had factions, which would be very different from our system. The senators were elected by the state legislatures, I'm reasonably sure, and not by the people. So that would again give you a somewhat less coherent system, as it were. But yeah, no, I think I assume they did. I mean, I think they talk about faction. They did. You'd have to go back to their documents and see what their solution is to preventing dynasties from developing, to preventing an oligarchy from developing, in a sense, which is in a sense part of the issue. The issue here. I should say, one of Renault's stories, I say, is set at the point where you've got a tyranny. And it's historical. I don't know how much she's making up it in any historical novel. But you've got a tyrant who, as she tells the story, was the younger lover of Solon. And basically, at some point, seizes power after Solon's reforms and enforces Solon's reforms. When he dies, his sons succeed to his power. Yeah, I don't think he has any official power. I think it's just that he's in a position to have enough followers so he can beat up people who don't do what he wants, more or less. And his sons sort of inherit his machine, as it were, and things run for a while, and then one of the sons commits a particularly gross injustice, and the result is that either one or both of them are assassinated by people who end up as heroes later on and have statues put to them. And I think the assassins are killed in the process. And that's sort of a part of the process that moves you towards. So I guess at Solon's point, I guess there was no king, and it was theoretically a democracy, but somebody successfully corrupted it, at least if you accept Renault's account, which I think you do, because I think the two people after that are definitely historical. Now, a different element. Aside from the political system, what might you do if you wanted to discourage oligarchy and things like that? What about non-political things? What's going to give you an oligarchy? An oligarchy could easily come out of the concentration of wealth.
Absolutely.
After money is very useful stuff. What's one of the ways within such a system that you might make it less likely that wealth would concentrate?
You can redistribute wealth.
Well, yeah, that's a little unpopular. Yeah?
Well, I know in the Roman system, the senators didn't have a salary while they were in the Senate, but the problem is usually only the people who already have money and can afford to live for a year without a salary.
That would be a possible problem. But I was thinking of non-political things. How about inheritance rules? What are the two most common inheritance rules historically?
Only passes to a maid, right?
That's true, but beyond that, what was the very common English rule? That's a rule which restricts land, but I was thinking of primogeniture. One rule is that the property or most of the property goes to the eldest son. A different rule is it's divided evenly among the sons. Which rule would you propose for Athens? That's what they did. That's right. So that would be an interesting sort of thing, which is in one sense non-political, but could have real political consequences. All right. Well, I suggest you do read the readings because they're actually quite a lot of fun. I understand that you've got lots of other priorities. I think we're out of time at this point, and